Thanks everyone for being here. I'd like to begin with a personal anecdote that feels important for me to explain why I'm even here today. So on November 9th, 2016, two things happened. The first one was that I turned 31, and the second was that Donald Trump was elected President of the United States. So that felt like quite a strange birthday present from the universe. And if you're wondering how it made me feel, then in the words of the Donald, sad. Actually, even more than sad, I felt shocked, I felt angered, and just very puzzled that a xenophobic climate denier had just become the head of the most powerful nation on this planet. So this felt like a wake-up call for me. It made me wonder what I was doing with my life, which was not really focused on matters of politics or society or social change. And it made me wonder what I could do to try and make things maybe a little less bad. So I went back to my readings and studies that I had done in the past on matters of, sustainable development, as it was called at the time. And I was reminded how we are all part of this mega machine, which is objectifying all of the living world, including human beings, to produce stuff and to enrich a small minority of people. I was also reminded of the accelerating climate crisis, of how our economic systems are absolutely wedded to exponential economic growth, and that this makes it really difficult to be switching to very different ways of being together as a society. And that we are in the midst of the sixth mass extinction of species too, not to mention widespread chemical plastic pollution, the rise of authoritarian governments, etc., etc. So this is the kind of situation which is often referred to under the term the polycrisis. So I was wondering what I could do about all of this, and was also reminded of those words by indigenous activist and researcher Kyle White, saying that what we are living in right now can already be considered a dystopia, actually, for the ancestors of indigenous people today. They would consider our world pretty much a dystopian future. So what could I do? Well, I was interested in the intersection of learning and action. And it felt to me that perhaps what was needed was something along the lines of better informed people who would then take action through better networks which would connect their efforts in order to enact social change. And eventually this reflection grew to encompass those three main areas. So that of online networks, the area of social or informal learning, and that of radical collective change. So by radical collective change, I mean responses, collective responses, which would be relevant in our time of polycrisis. And by social informal learning, I mean how people learn from each other and influence one another in all kinds of social settings. So I'm interested in how we are learning from each other all the time, and how this may be connected to social change. So eventually I went back to university, reluctantly, to do a transdisciplinary PhD research on those questions. And my main research question was, how may online networks then enable radical collective change through social learning? My partner and I created a little website which summarizes some of the main insights of this thesis, and in which you can also read the whole doctoral thesis that was published earlier this month. So please feel free to go and check it out and leave your comments or get in touch. So what I'm going to be sharing about today is some of the insights that felt most interesting to me during the course of those 5 years of study. So first, a little more about my approach. So I consider myself an aspiring activist scholar. My interest is in challenging unjust social structures through the production of knowledge and involvement in various social change efforts. This doesn't mean that when I get involved with a particular group or community that I am going to be praising everything they do, because I don't think that's necessarily helpful. Rather, in the words of David Graeber, my interest is in trying to see what's happening and then offering those ideas back to the people who are involved in those efforts, not as prescriptions, but as contributions, as possibilities, or as gifts. So even though some of those gifts may be of a bit more critical nature, it's always in the interest of furthering the cause defended by those various groups. I'm also very interested in the approach of action research, which is a very open-ended and flexible approach to creating knowledge, in which one keeps going through cycles of action and reflection and planning, etc., which is also participatory. So this is something really important. All I'm going to be sharing with you today is not just my little insights, but is actually has been co-produced with dozens of people as co-researchers involved in different levels of depth. And it's also an approach which encourages one to always keep reflecting on one's assumptions and where we're coming from, etc., etc. So the two communities I'm going to be talking about today are prefigurative online communities. So that means that they are people who interact online around a shared purpose, interest, or need, and who seek to embody in how they function those forms of social relations and decision-making, culture, and human experience that they consider ultimately beneficial for the whole of society. So, to put it simply, it's like being the change that you want to see in the world, right? So, those are the kind of communities that I've been working with and researching with. So, the first one I'm going to be talking about is called Fair Co-op, and the second one, the Deep Adaptation Forum. I also want to mention that many of my insights that I'm going to be talking about today came from my involvement in fields of discussion around decolonial theory and practice, notably the Diversity and Decolonizing Circle, which I was part of for a time in the Deep Adaptation Forum, and with the Gesturing Towards Decolonial Futures Collective, which is an arts and research collective of activists and researchers and artists and educators from the Global North and the Global South. I'm not part of this collective, but much of what it has been doing has been very useful to me, very insightful. So to put it in a nutshell, what I'm going to be talking about today is a theory, which I'm just beginning to outline, of how radical change may be created in prefigurative communities. So this theory is articulated in two parts. I think that the first set of broad conditions has to do with the presence of a social ecosystem which favors trust and belonging, conflict transformation, critical discernment, and distributed leadership. So that's what I call a community of care and critical discernment. And the second set of conditions, which is more underground, is a mycelium of change-focused initiatives that are trying to compost four denials of modernity, coloniality. So this may sound a bit complex. I'm going to try and go through those different parts one by one, and hopefully it will become a bit clearer. So I'm going to first talk about the forest, the four trees that we saw at the top here. And I'm going to illustrate this part by talking about this first community called Fair Co-op. It was mostly active from 2014 to 2019 and was started in the region of Catalonia in Spain by radical, mostly anarchist-leaning activists around someone called Enric Duran, whom some of you may know, and then spread around different places in Europe and around the world. So FairCoop's aim was mostly around creating new economic and social structures. So that was how their objective was to create an alternative economic field which would be post-capitalist and which would be enabling people to slowly extract themselves from the exploitative capitalist systems that we know and to start living very different lifestyles based on solidarity, mutual help, etc. All of this centered around an ecological cryptocurrency called Faircoin. So as I was really interested in all this field of alternative currencies at the time, I really wanted to get deeply into this community to understand what was going on. So for those few years, FairCoop was quite successful at uniting hundreds of people around various projects. So we have here Freedom Coop, which is that enables people to launch their own business and to be sending out invoices without relying on banks and states. We have the Bank of the Commons, a really interesting project also, which is like an alternative bank for activists. An online marketplace called Use Faircoin. All of this using this cryptocurrency of Faircoin as the kind of lifeblood and being connected with dozens of local groups of activists around different countries. So this was really impressive to me, really inspiring as a collection of tools and alternative structures enabling people to do interesting things. However, when I started my research within the community, I found that it was deeply fractured by conflict and actually in a state of crisis. So I asked people there to work with me to figure out what had happened and what could we learn from those problems in order to maybe do better in the future. So this will enable us to go through those four trees one by one. First, I think that a community of care and critical discernment needs to foster trust and belonging. And this has to happen through an ethics of care and centering relationships in order to help people to really deeply trust one another and collaborate better with one another, but also to better live with the uncertainty and the state of increasing ambiguity and volatility that is a characteristic of our world nowadays. And it's becoming all the more important with growing social ecological crisis and intensifying state repression also and authoritarianism. We have to learn how to trust one another and find a state of belonging with the groups, affinity groups, that we are part of. So in FairCoop, I found that there was actually much more attention to developing software and tools rather than centering care and relationships. And so when conflict erupted, the fabric of the community was actually quite weak. Second condition is around conflict. I believe that conflict transformation in any community is something that is absolutely crucial because conflict will happen. And so how can we better normalize it and make it something that is okay to be in conflict with other people? And this requires containers for conflict to be addressed and to be transformed. So it requires processes and agreements for people to actually feel safe, to go through steps to understand one another better and to then develop maybe an even stronger sense of trust and stronger bonds of community and comradeship. Now this, again, was not present in FairCoop. There was a lack of conflict management processes And so when conflict appeared, then it was really difficult to work with. I also think that critical discernment in a community is vital to hear dissident voices and to keep reflecting on what are we doing this for, and how are we going about fulfilling our mission and purpose, and are we still on the right track? And to favor discussions that are critical on those different aspects, on the personal and collective level, feels just extremely important for this this ongoing reflection to happen. And again, in Fair Co-op, there was little space for critical voices, which felt many of the people who were critical of the governance, for example, of the community, felt silenced, and then conflict just blew out of proportions. And finally, leadership, I think, is also an aspect which is often neglected in particularly horizontal aspiring communities. Leadership is often equated with top-down hierarchies and business suits and what have you, and I also felt this way for a while. But there is a way for leadership to be distributed, to be emergent, to be for conditions to be created so that anyone with an inspiring idea and who feels enthusiasm for a project can actually feel capable of stepping up and doing something cool with other people who will join this person. And this also requires recognizing the skill and experience of what I call key enablers, so people who are in the community and who have a lot to offer for the benefit of the collective learning. In Fair Co-op, leadership was very much concentrated within a few people, from what I understood, and there were also accountability issues so that the leaders who did not consider themselves leaders, but who were considered leaders by other people, were actually not really held to account for when they were doing things. So in summary, for Fair Co-op, I have been really impressed with all the energy and enthusiasm and skill and all the powerful tools that have been created within this community with the funding and enthusiasm that they managed to raise. However, it seems that there was too much focus on tech engineering and a little too little on relational glue holding people together so that when an obstacle or crisis emerges in the community, people can still be together and work it out. Now I'm going to focus a bit more on the second set of conditions that we saw in the earlier image, so the underground thing. And I'm going to do this through the example of a second community, the Deep Adaptation Forum, which was started in 2019. Contrary to Fair Co-op, the Deep Adaptation Forum was less focused on creating alternative social and economic structures, and much more on fostering cultural change, deep cultural change, which is usually phrased in the network as enabling and embodying loving responses to the observation or anticipation of the collapse of modern industrial societies. So in the Deep Adaptation Forum, participants consider that industrial societies, modern industrial societies, are going to collapse. Either this is likely, or it's inevitable, or it's already started. And so the idea is, well, how can we deal with the situation and create cultural change, which is on the level of this state of crisis that we're in? And this is both on the individual and collective and even societal scales. The Deep Adaptation Forum is a loosely connected bunch of self-organized groups and platforms in various languages, mostly in English at the moment, but there's also a very big Hungarian group and French group. It is held together or enabled through a scaffolding of self-organization. So groups have some processes that they can easily apply in order to start their own thing. In the Deep Adaptation Forum, I found that two of the trees of generative communities were also lacking, but that two seem to be quite well in place. But I'm now going to speak a bit more about this underground part, so the mycelium of change to compost denials of modernity. First, I don't know if everyone is fluent with the term modernity coloniality. A very simple and simplistic way of putting it is that everything that we enjoy as modern human beings, all our comforts and privileges, have a dark side of exploitation and extraction. So for example, a person enjoying the use of a laptop, well, comes with a child slave laborer in the Congo, to give a very kind of caricature example, in cobalt mines. So this is how sociologists have been forging this term modernity coloniality as a single word, because the bright side is really, really hard to distinguish from the darker side. So the Gesturing Towards Decolonial Futures Collective consider that deep cultural change can only happen once four denials of modernity coloniality are addressed. I'm going to give you an overview of those four denials, which are like toxic elements in our cultural soil which are preventing the social change from really happening. So it's like obstacles to the change that we need. The first is the denial of unsustainability, so the denial of the limits of the planet, and that we are living inside and being part of a finite Earth metabolism which cannot sustain exponential growth and consumption and extraction and exploitation and expropriation indefinitely. This is something that cannot happen. And yet, most of us in our societies are looking away from this. There's the denial of systemic, historical, and ongoing violence and complicity in harm, which is connected to the image I showed just a bit earlier. So the fact that we are enjoying everything in our societies because of exploitation, because of ongoing violence, and so we are complicit in this state of violence and exploitation. The denial of entanglement, which is the fact that we are all connected as part of this living planet metabolism, and we cannot distinguish, we cannot separate an individual from another, and humanity from nature, and a race from another race. We are all part of the same thing, the same living body that is biointelligent. And finally, there's the denial of the magnitude and complexity of the problems that we need to face together. So we tend to look for quick fixes, a new technology to solve climate change, another one to solve plastic pollution, whatever. And instead, we don't really dig deep enough to see that it's much more complicated than that. So how were those four denials addressed in the Deep Adaptation Forum? First of all, the denial of unsustainability and of the magnitude of the issues were sort of baked into the framing of the network when it started, because of this framing of collapsing society due to the unsustainability of our modern and colonial societies. So those two denials are sort of part of the discourse or the conversations going on everywhere in the network. The denial of entanglement is a bit less closely considered. Some groups do try to have processes in which they recognize, for example, how ideas and emotions may circulate from one person to another, how we are connected with the wider forces of life and the planet and the universe and what have you, but it's still something which is only for certain groups. And likewise, for systemic injustice, it has more recently become more central as part of the discourse of the network, but for many years it was an area of conversation which was mostly carried by one group, the Diversity and Decolonizing Circle, which I mentioned earlier. So this leads us to this idea of the mycelium. What do I mean by that? Well, my sense is that for those four extremely complex and deep sets of issues to be addressed, one person or one group obviously cannot be enough. What is needed is interconnected projects and networks and communities focused on social learning that will work on those toxic elements in the ground, just like fungi are vital to compost organic matter in the soil. So it's about creating those connections of information and resources and participation and involvement so that this deep change can possibly happen. In the Deep Adaptation Forum, I found that there were some small cells, you might say, of potential change that were starting to emerge thanks to the online tools that people were using on some of those aspects. But I also found that these cells were not really closely connected enough. So for example, you might have a person involved in the diversity and decolonizing circle, really focused on systemic injustice, but not really focused, say, on, well, entanglement and the interconnectedness of everything. Just like Fair Co-op, I don't think that the Deep Adaptation Forum have had enough potential to create radical collective change. So to wrap up, my little outline of a theory which I've just been sharing with you today can be summarized as such. So in the right conditions, social conditions of mutual care and conflict transformation, distributed leadership and critical discernment, a community can help really useful initiatives to emerge. And then these initiatives, when confronting the denials of modernity and collaborating and networking very closely, can help deep personal and collective changes to happen. So for people to undergo transformative changes in their lives, personally and collectively. So ICT, information and communication tools, can be really useful for people from all around the world to be part of groups in which they can have this kind of social learning ongoing and to connect people and ideas. But we shouldn't forget, obviously, that tools can also be obstacles to the learning and to social change. So we can think of the example of cobalt mining, for example, for computers, but also echo chambers, how we tend to try to stay within our little comfortable bubbles of truth and conversation and not really hear what other people are saying or just demonizing them on social media when they seem to be saying something that doesn't really fit with our worldview. Polarization around certain issues, etc., etc. So, or even the idea that technology itself is the solution to everything. So that's also something that we shouldn't fall into, I think. Secondly, inner behavioral changes have to also be to spread and to become embodied into new social, political, economic structures. It shouldn't be enough to just be content with our little groups of conversations and then just let current governments stay as they are. So in pursuing social change, my sense is that we have to pay attention to process and be humble. In the words of the Gesturing Towards Decolonial Futures Collective, how can we move together differently towards a future that is undefined without arrogance, self-righteousness, dogmatism, and perfectionism? That's my question for you today. So I'm really looking forward to deepening this area of explorations with other people, with other collectives. So if you have an interest in collaborating or in discussing those ideas further, please get in touch. There's my email there, as well as the address of the website on which you can find much more about all of this. And I've tried to create summaries which are maybe a bit more accessible to non-academics, because I know that reading a thesis is not exactly something that everyone should have to do ever in their lives. Or writing one, obviously. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dorian, for your interesting presentation, inspiring presentation, I might say. So we have a bit of time for Q&A, and there's also the single agent, so everybody who is listening or watching from the internet, hashtag 33C 3SUSE is the hashtag for participating in RCR Mastodon. And I would also start with the Signal Angel if there is any question from the internet.
Hi. So there's a bit of feedback, which is a great talk. And the question would be, are there strategies for minimizing the chance of humans with undesired characteristics, power-hungry, controlling, narcissistic, greedy, and so on, gaining roles of influence in anarchistic communities?
There are strategies, and I don't think I would either be qualified or have the time to say too much. There are books like The Empowerment Manual, written by a veteran activist Starhawk, that I would really recommend, that touches on those issues. My sense is that if an anarchist group can rely on a set of commonly agreed principles of operation and a baseline reference point for certain kinds of behaviors. So for example, how do we deal with someone who is being very destructive in their in the way they speak or act? Then this can already be extremely helpful, but it's really about this self-empowerment, I think, to maintain an atmosphere that is helpful to everyone, for everyone to learn and to want to keep their relationships going and their collaborations going.
Okay. Reminder, if you want to ask questions here on site, line up at the microphones for here in the hall. And next question is from microphone two.
Yes, thank you. Interesting talk. I was wondering, you took some pre-existing communities and were looking at, you know, breakpoints and so on in these communities. Do you have any suggestions to, like, what can you do to, if you want to start a community, what kind of preconditions would have to be met and so on, specifically thinking about how in the Fediverse there's a lot of discussion about just a bunch of servers versus community building. If you have an instance, how can you make it more like a community? Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Well, my sense is that community weaving is an art, and network weaving is also another word that is used. And my number one response would be to really nurture relationships between people. Make it fun, make it something that is energizing for people to connect and to want to be in relationship and to collaborate together. So this goes through not only finding projects that are federating people, but also for people to have occasions to reveal more about themselves, about their passions, about their fears, about their dreams, and for all of this to come out. Because I think we live in a culture that is very action focused. We want to get things done. We want to be busy all the time, and this can be really helpful for interesting projects to emerge and develop. But we sacrifice a lot of the essential dimensions of being a human in the process. And I think this is perhaps one of the things that happened with Fair Co-op. I would just encourage anyone wanting to start a community to start small and with people who are really interested in a similar range of topics, and then to really look for ways of encouraging deep connections between them, so that they really have this sense of trust and interest in one another. And then this can slowly build as the culture solidifies. More people will be attracted to this group of people, and maybe something quite big can actually begin like this.
Okay, is there another question from the internet? Because they are not here. Go ahead.
The question is it even possible to establish a sense of belonging for beings that are by default so inherently different? You perhaps can find some common grounds, but a total sense of belonging, how would you even try to attempt this? And even if you succeed, how you keep the continuity?
Well, I wouldn't know what a total sense of belonging would mean. My sense is that every single person has a sense of belonging to a lot of different groups. So if I think of myself, for example, I feel a sense of belonging to my family, to my groups of friends, to the people I work with, but it's just, it's different each time. There's different nuances and textures. So I wouldn't say that we have to aim for people to become blood brothers and sisters with everyone that they work with forever, or, you know, I mean, it's, especially through the internet, that's kind of complicated. But at least to have a sense that I really like hanging out with those folks. I like having those conversations. I like working with them. I like, you know, meeting them and trying to create a better world with them. That's already something that will slowly create a sense of belonging, I think. Particularly if we understand how the characteristics of those people that we like and enjoy interacting with correspond to some of our own characteristics. So be it dreams, be it domains of competence, all those things. So yeah, just don't aim for total and absolute belonging, definitely not, but just try to build a little more everywhere you are, would be my answer.
Okay, microphone 3, please.
Yes. Yeah, thank you for your talk. I was curious, and I was wondering if you would like to share a little bit more about the PAR process, the participatory action research, and in particular, I was curious to learn a little bit about how these, you know, four trees and four subterranean clusters, how they kind of emerged in the course of your working with your co-researchers, and what that process looked like a little bit more concretely. Thank you.
Well, so first of all, the four denials of modernity underground are not my work. They are from the Gesturing Towards Decolonial Futures Collective, but I just find it a really useful metaphor to use, so I integrated within my reflection. As for the four trees, I would say that they emerged from repeated conversations within both the Deep Adaptation Forum and the Fair Co-op communities that led to many overlaps forming. So for example, when a certain group was saying, well, you know, we really like to work together and we've been doing all those great things because of this element, that factor. And then another group said, well, yeah, us too, we have this one and that one. And so there's it led to creating a kind of heat map, I would say, of really interesting recurring patterns that that seem to be useful. Then I would say that the four trees is a formulation that I came up with in the end, in the process of writing my thesis. But yeah, all of the work of identifying those patterns was collective and involved dozens of people through different contexts that were really focused on examining how we learn in our communities and in groups. So it was this participatory process that, in the end, I just crystallized in a few suggestions.
Okay, we have time for one more question. Are you queuing? Okay, then microphone 1, please.
All right, thanks again for your talk. It was really nice presented, so very comprehensible. And my question is, you talked about the Actually, even the recommendation from the first questions to focus on bonding groups and to socialize. So did you get further into the details of how they do it? So do they use certain concepts, starting from sociocracy or even other concepts to use for collaboration and for actual social interaction?
Thanks. I would say there are two maybe broad sets of, again, recurring patterns in developing relationships. On the one hand, you have structures and processes, and so you mentioned sociocracy, for example, so this is something that is used a lot in the Deep Adaptation Forum, and which is a methodology that really helps people to feel empowered when it's well done, and to distribute distribute the sense of collective agency and decision making. So this is extremely important as again a set of agreements that people can fall back on when to feel reassured that their voice will be heard. And you have also different different kinds of say group building processes, you know, using a structured approach so that everyone shares their dream, for example, shares their fears, shares why they are here, you know, and using those kind of processes, particularly early on in the life of a group, can be extremely helpful. But then there's also a second kind of big set of practices, which is just impossible to even formalize because it's the basics of interacting with people. So it's like finding time, you know, like around the water cooler, you know, in the metaphor of a workplace, but it's even when you meet online with people, find some times where you're just chatting, where you're just sharing a coffee, sharing drinks, and joking around, and getting this sense of getting a bit below the surface of the person, and, you know, getting more familiar with their with the real human behind the group participant. And this cannot really be taught. It's just a matter of finding the right vibes that work with people to rub off one another a bit more. But both are really important, I think.
So, speaking about chatting, where will people be finding you here at Congress? Can they get in touch with you to continue the discussion?
Well, I tend to hang out quite a bit around fifth stand, so the Bits and Boima area. Otherwise, they can also just email me at this email address, and we'll find a way to connect, I think.
Perfect. This concludes this session, and a big round of applause for Dorian.